It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at an effort to bring together Milwaukee communities with urban agriculture.
First, we're checking in on the latest news from the Joint Finance Committee. The committee is trying to finish its work on Governor Scott Walker's budget by the end of the month. Yesterday, they voted on public education funding, drug testing for recipients of some state benefits, and more.
Here to give us an overview of what the Joint Finance Committee accomplished so far this week is Sean Johnson, WPR's State Capitol reporter. Sean, welcome back.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, last time I talked to you, I asked if you thought they'd have any late night sessions of Joint Finance. You said yes, and lo and behold, how late did they go last night?
They finished up at 1:27 a.m., so finished up the big education motion about that time. And I think yesterday was probably noteworthy for the amount of time they actually spent in their chairs discussing this stuff. Usually when they stay late, they're kind of having a lot of closed-door meetings, and there's not a lot of actual committee meeting happening, but they were there a lot yesterday.
And they did a lot. And before we get into the specifics, as I understand, mostly or even completely party-line votes, Republicans yes, Democrats no?
Almost completely on every issue, yeah. I don't think I've seen any issue this year that Republicans have splintered. So every now and then you'll get a couple Democrats that'll join Republicans on a motion, but you haven't seen Republicans split up and, you know, have the 12 GOP members of the committee vote different ways. They've been in lockstep this year.
Let's get into some details here. Joint Finance voted to increase spending on public schools. Governor Walker originally proposed cutting public school funding. So how did this deal get reached?
Yeah, what they did is the governor proposed cutting public schools in the first year of the budget by about $127 million. And what Joint Finance did last night is they filled that cut. And then they spent about another $70 million on top of that. So you're looking at they essentially increased school spending by $70 million once they filled the governor's cut. How they did that, the bulk of it is they delayed a payment, an extra payment to the school levy tax credit until the next budget. So that's something the state doesn't have to worry about right now. To kind of oversimplify this, that tax credit is there to lower property taxes. What they did won't affect property taxes. It will affect the way that ratings agencies like Standard & Poor's look at the state's budget. They'll say that, you know, the gap deficit went up. But as far as schools are concerned, you know, they'll get that money when they need it. It'll just technically appear in a different fiscal year than the one in which they use it.
Now, that was the big headline when it came to education, but there was a lot more going on with education, too. Part of that school funding plan is affected by and affects voucher schools as well. What happened there?
Yeah, they made some huge changes with voucher schools, and I think, actually, if you look at the way that they funded vouchers this time around, it eats into any increase that the public schools got. So what they did is they modeled the expansion of vouchers going forward along the lines of the way that the state pays for open enrollment. So there is a $48 million increase to vouchers in this budget that is completely offset by a $48 million decrease to public schools. So, you know, that's a significant number, obviously. And, you know, I think it sets the states up for going forward. That's how vouchers are going to go, is that as they expand, the funding that flows to voucher schools will come directly from the local schools that are losing these students.
Talking to WPR's Sean Johnson about the latest from the Joint Finance Committee as they go through the governor's budget. A little outside of education funding here, Sean, JFC, their plan calls for different education guidelines and school ratings than the governor had proposed. So what's different there?
Yeah, there's a lot of education policy they stuck in there that is not essential to balancing the budget or finding funding for public schools or finding funding for private voucher schools, that matter. One of the things that they did go along with partially, go along with the governor on, is this school accountability report, that something they haven't been able to agree upon in the legislature. In fact, some of the rank and file lawmakers that were working on it very recently declared the issue dead. Not so much, though, because they were able to, at least the members of the Joint Finance Committee, or the 12 Republicans there, were able to agree to an accountability system that would not punish poor performing schools. So, you know, that was one of the big issues between the Assembly and the Senate on this. It would create a new rating system for schools, though. It's not a letter grade system that a lot of school advocates had said would be a bad idea, and could kind of give the wrong idea about schools. It's close, though. You've got a star rating system now for schools in this budget. They'd be rated on a scale of 1 through 5 stars to denote how they're performing on new school tests.
Now, stepping away from schools now, drug testing for food share recipients, I understand, was on the table yesterday, proposal from the governor. Republican lawmakers have talked about this. How did that end up getting resolved?
Yeah, not just drug testing for food share recipients. The governor's budget pretty much covered the gamut. There was a food share recipients. He would drug test for Badger Care recipients, not all recipients, so parents wouldn't be tested. But if you're an adult without kids on Badger Care Plus and you're a so-called able-bodied adult, they would drug test you. Unemployment insurance recipients would be drug tested. People who receive W-2, which is Wisconsin's replacement for traditional welfare. I mean, it's the program that came about during Tommy Thompson's welfare changes in the 90s. Recipients of W-2 would be drug tested. So a very sweeping proposal there by the Joint Finance Committee. And at least for some of it, they would not require the state to get a federal waiver. So the thinking was with a lot of these is, okay, they're going to ask the state to get permission from the federal government. The federal government will say no, and these changes will never happen. Well, if they don't ask the federal government for permission and they go ahead with it, that sets up a different scenario. It's likely going to prompt a court challenge, and these changes could end up getting blocked that way. A federal judge could potentially step in and say, you can't do this under the U.S. Constitution.
So that's interesting. Instead of trying to get that permission that wasn't expected, they're maybe paving the way to a big legal battle over this.
Yeah, and you know, politically, even if they lose, they could paint it as a win. I mean, they could say that judge blocked this reform is probably how they'd frame it, and you know, that they wanted to do it, but the federal court system got in the way. I guess the other alternative is they win in court and that they're able to go ahead and do this, but this is something that Republicans have been able to keep all their members together on and seem happy to talk about.
Those are the highlights from yesterday. I understand Joint Finance is meeting again tomorrow before the holiday weekend. What's on the schedule? What are we going to be watching for?
Well, as of right now, the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation is still on the schedule. This is the agency known as WEDIC, the state's premier economic development agency. One of the first initiatives Governor Walker pushed for when he became governor in 2011. And this is an agency that has had all sorts of trouble recently with audits showing they're not following state law or their own policies when it comes to tracking awards. And Wisconsin State Journal story over the weekend showing that Walker's Department of Administration Secretary Mike Hipsch tried to steer a $4.3 million state loan to a then failing company that is now defunct, after that company gave Walker's campaign $10,000. So if WEDIC is up tomorrow, that's going to be a political football, and there's a lot of money involved too. They want $55 million. Initially they asked for $55 million to continue this loan program. The governor over the weekend said, I don't want that anymore. We're done with the loan program. So we'll see what happens there.
Sean, thanks as always for joining us.
You're welcome.
That's Sean Johnson, WPR state government reporter, with us to talk about the Joint Finance Committee's latest votes on the governor's budget. In the early days of Central Time, we met Venus Williams for a look at Alice's Garden, an urban agriculture project in Milwaukee. We talked to her about the ways different ethnic groups in the city came together and shared their different relationships with the land and with farming.
With the growing season here once again, we're checking in with her about the latest from Alice's Garden, including a new farm stand opening in June that takes the group's mission into a new direction. Venus Williams is in our Milwaukee studio. She's the director of Alice's Garden Urban Farm. Venus, welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Well, so before we visit the farm stand, it is growing season again, more or less, here in Wisconsin. What's coming up so far that you're excited about?
So yesterday I did an herbal workshop on tinctures and decoctions and infusions, and I was able to harvest many herbs, lovage and catmint, fennel, some sage, some spearmint, apple mint. So as a perennial herb farmer, there's a lot going on, even though it feels like autumn today.
And I know we've been talking about lovage here at the studio lately. I get some from my CSA. Can't quite get myself to like it. Venus, can you make me love lovage?
Yes, I can make you love lovage. Why don't you boil it and use it as a decoction that will help heal your body in many ways. One of the benefits of lovage is when you drink it, it actually works from the inside out, dealing with eczema and acne and other skin irritations. So you don't have to cook with it. You could actually use it as a tea.
Huh.
Oh, that's a new one,
Worth
Rob.
A shot? Okay,
yeah.
I will try that.
We'll get you back on this love and bandwagon yet. So, Venus, as we mentioned, the farm stand is opening up next month. What is the goal of that part of the new project?
So it's wonderful. The city of Milwaukee is allowing farm stands in ways that have not been permitted before. So very often people come by Alice's Garden wanting to purchase fresh produce from the garden, and we have not in the past been doing that. But this year, beginning mid-June, the second or third week of June, on Monday evenings only, we will have a farm stand that will both sell fresh produce from Alice's Garden along with our herbal product line. So we're really excited. We're going to set up a stand right at 20th and Garfield and be available to the public in a way that we have not been available in that community.
And farm stands are a great part of, you know, small towns, rural communities. We've got some in the Madison area. What does this mean for Milwaukee that yours and maybe other farm stands are going to be popping up?
Well, we have intentionally chosen Monday as the day that we will have our farm stand because the Fondy Farmers Market is closed. So we are looking at even providing, filling in a gap within the neighborhood and that area of town. So as you drive past 20th Street, which is a very busy street at rush hour time and both in the morning, people will be able to just pull to the side and purchase their greens or tomatoes, peppers, herbs, herbal products right there again in the community where all of these fresh goodies have been grown.
Now, you mentioned herbs, and I know that herbs hold a special place in your heart, and they'll be at the farm stand as well. Could you tell us about some of the different things you're going to be doing with herbs in that aspect of it?
So, again, yesterday with the workshop, one of the things that I shared, we are expanding our herbal produce line this season. I am waiting for a delivery, literally. I'm hoping it's going to be there today from an herb company out of Canada called Richter's. So we are expanding into garlic mint and, there are so many different herbs, ginger mint. My favorite new herb that I'm growing this year that I've only grown for myself is fenugreek. So we are really expanding to about a quarter acre or so, more like a quarter acre of fenugreek, which is an incredible herb that I have fallen in love with over the past 6 months. So constantly with us, we're looking to move beyond what people traditionally purchase at a market. So we're used to buying basic spearmint or peppermint or chives or parsley and so on, but we are really adding to our herbal selection, and all of that will be available fresh at all the different markets that we'll be at this summer and especially at our farm stand on Monday evenings.
Talking to Venus Williams with the Alice's Garden Urban Agriculture Project in Milwaukee. Venus, I know a lot of people look at urban agriculture as this new trend, this exciting new thing. You say no, it's been around a long time. What traditions are you tapping into with Alice's Garden?
with Alice's Garden, with me personally, and with many of our gardeners and farmers there, we all have a long ancestral history of growing food. And so whether we originate from small towns in Mississippi and Alabama, as many folks in our community do, we didn't leave those agricultural traditions behind. And for us, what is also important in urban agriculture is the word culture in agriculture. So we really look at not just how those who raised us or raised the generations before us grew food, but what that food means to them, what preparing meals means and holding on to family tradition. So it's about the growing of food, but we also do a whole lot of cooking and grilling and preparing of dishes with the fresh produce at Alice's Garden.
Are there new food traditions and favorite recipes that have grown up and helped strengthen the community through that bond of food?
I don't know that there are new food traditions, but what we want to do is help people reclaim what has already been there. So on Tuesday evenings, we have a program called Reclaiming and Nourishing Family Traditions. And during that project, we invite people to bring in favorite family recipes or the things that you like to put on the grill. We also have burners. And so it really is about sharing our family traditions, not so much reinventing any, but just reclaiming what has always been there. And for many of us, we never walked away from it. I think that's one of the myths of urban agriculture, is that it's something that we left and are coming back to. Alice's Garden itself has been there since 1972. There are other gardens in the city that are even older. As we talk to the elders in the community who came to the city of Milwaukee in the 40s and the 50s, they will tell you about extension gardens that they farmed at in the early 50s. So it is not a new movement. It is just a broader movement now.
Venus, thank you so much for joining us, and I wish you a bountiful growing season.
Thank you, and the same to you.
That was Venus Williams, Executive Director of Alice's Garden in Milwaukee. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up later, we'll look at the massive airbag recall hitting the auto industry.
First, as the state budget process winds on and legislators debate how to make up for a revenue shortfall, we're going to take stock of Wisconsin's economic well-being.
Earlier this month, UW economist Noah Williams wrote an op-ed in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel saying that despite media reports, some to the contrary, Wisconsin is outpacing many other states economically.
The piece attracted plenty of comments and sparked back and forth in the pages of the Journal Sentinel opinion section over just how well the state is faring, better or worse than the rest of the country.
To figure out an answer to that question, we've invited UW-Madison economics professor Noah Williams to join us. Noah, welcome to the studio.
Hi, thanks for having me. Glad to be here.
And also here, UW-Madison applied economics professor Stephen Deller. Stephen, thanks for joining us.
Good afternoon.
Well, we'll get into some details in a bit, but first, big picture, I want to get a sense from each of you how Wisconsin's economy is doing. Let's start with Noah.
So as I said in my piece, I think, overall, at least relative to other states and relative to the nation as a whole, the economic situation in Wisconsin could be described as relatively good. In many dimensions, stronger than the national averages.
Okay. And big picture, Stephen, your thoughts?
Well, it depends on how you define good, and it depends on what economic indicator that you're looking at. One of the things that is kind of a running joke amongst economic policy analysts is give us enough time, we can make the numbers say anything you want them to say. So depending on what indicators you look at, the state's doing okay, but other indicators, the state is lagging behind.
And that's, as we dig into the details here, I think some people will be listening, myself included, hearing lots of different indicators, hearing lots of numbers and thinking, okay, can we prove anything with these numbers? I mean, are we in a postmodern world of economics, or is there a basis for truth that we can sort of agree on the basic facts? Noah.
Well, I think, so that's why we don't want to necessarily tie ourselves to any one particular indicator or any one particular time period. So you have to, the data are noisy, and there's different ways of measuring, even trying to get at some of the same underlying object. So we need to take sort of a broader picture and try to average across broader indicators and try to really get a sense of what is the overall picture. And I think once we do that, the preponderance of the evidence that I've looked at suggests that things are doing pretty well.
And Stephen, your thoughts, what kind of things should we be looking at to diagnose the relative well-being of a state's economy?
Well, that's a value judgment type question, because it's really kind of a reflection of what do you hold as important. During certain times, it's jobs, 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 and we don't care what kind of jobs they are as long as they're jobs. Other times, we're worried more about the quality of the jobs in terms of, say, the pay that's offered, the benefits that are offered. So it really varies on, you know, what do you hold as value in terms of economic growth and economic development?
Let's talk about jobs numbers now. Currently, unemployment rate below the national unemployment average, 4.8% compared to 5.5%, I think, nationally. 4.8, I mean, that's generally, I think, considered a pretty good number. A sign, Stephen, we'll start with you this time, a sign that we're doing pretty well.
Well, if you look at that, no, again, this is where you can cherry pick the numbers. I mean, right now there are six different ways that you can define unemployment. So which one are you going to look at? If you look at the standard one, the one that gets most of the attention, Wisconsin's actually not doing too bad. But again, depending on how you want to look at it, I mean, if you look at the 72 counties in Wisconsin, 46 of them, the unemployment rate is above the national average. And indeed, there's six of them that actually have unemployment rates in the double digits. Now, having said that, some of the bigger counties in Wisconsin, like Dane County, and Outagamie County, Osage County, the unemployment rate's relatively low. So how do you want to make that decision?
Well, and I know there are different ways to measure unemployment, but if we keep going with the one that currently says it's 4.8%, I mean, that gives us a basis for comparison to last quarter and 10 years ago and things like that. I know there are other ways to measure it, but if we watch this one thing over time, doesn't that give us a valid sense of where we are now?
Well, part of it is, again, how do we define it? One of the things that I thought of is that when you look at employment growth, we don't see the employment growth in the state that would be driving the unemployment rate down. So you think, well, maybe it's the labor force participation rate. People are giving up and leaving the market. Well, that doesn't seem to be what's happening. So I think what's going on here is that we're seeing what a lot of economists call reactionary entrepreneurship. People are getting frustrated. They can't find the employment that they want, so they start a business. So technically they're employed, but yet that's not optimal for that individual.
Noah?
So I guess I haven't actually seen any evidence to that. I don't know if you've seen that. And just a correction, I do believe the number is 4.6, so it's even better.
Sorry. I mean, old numbers.
So one of the things that we try to look at is what happens to participation over time. So a big decline nationally in the unemployment rate has been people leaving the labor force. Some of that is due to longer run demographic factors. The workforce is getting older. Baby boomers are starting to retire. But there does seem to be a relatively large cyclical component to that. So just even looking at that one indicator, just if unemployment rate falls, you want to dig a little bit deeper and say, you know, what's happened to participation? And there, I think the difference between what's happened in Wisconsin and what's happened nationally is a little bit stronger. There, because we've seen that, again, from the high, labor force participation has declined in Wisconsin, but it's remained relatively stable, and I think we agree on that. Looking at job growth, which is sort of turns out to be sort of what the crux of this argument or where the argument is, and was really what sort of inspired me to dig into the data, is I'd seen sort of the conflicting stories about what's happened to job growth versus what's happened to unemployment. And it's true that if you look at sort of the headline job growth figures, Wisconsin has grown at a slower rate than nationally, at least over the last few years. But in those headline numbers, those are non-farm payrolls. So that excludes self-employment and it excludes farm employment. And if you look, so the data which underlies the unemployment rate, on the other hand, is actually measures of employment. So there are two different surveys. One, they go around and ask households, basically, are you employed or not? Another, they go around and ask business firms, or actually establishments, locations of business firms, how many people are working for you. So they're trying to get at similar underlying things, but they're actually measuring different things, employment versus job growth on non-farm payrolls. And if you look at sort of the broader measure of employment, Wisconsin has done relatively better.
That's Noah Williams, UW-Madison economist. Also with us, Stephen Deller, economist at UW-Madison. They are answering the question, how is Wisconsin's economy doing? Well, that job growth issue has been a big one. And Noah, in the original piece you wrote, you were making the case that maybe job growth numbers are a little lower compared to the rest of the country, but it's like a kind of like a spring. Maybe some other states declined more in the Great Recession. They've got more room and more momentum to bounce back. So by comparison, it looks like we're going slower. Well, we had less room to grow. Is that, am I restating that correctly?
Yes. No, I think that's fair. And certainly, so a lot of the reports that sort of spurred my interest were just looking at the rankings of states by job growth, and along those dimensions, a state like Michigan has been performing well over the past few years. If you know anything about what's gone on in Detroit and Michigan more broadly, you wouldn't necessarily say that that's an overall healthy economy. It may be doing better than it had been previously, but that's largely due to the fact that it had declined so much. So, sort of in general, we sort of, a way to think about the economy is that there's some sort of underlying trend growth rate. And if we get pushed off that trend, well, then we should expect, unless something, has changed the trend, that we should grow faster in, say, coming out of a recession. So in looking at the employment numbers, not the job growth numbers, Wisconsin didn't fall as much in the recession. So therefore, over the recovery, it hasn't grown as fast. But I wouldn't say that that's a sign that we're not healthy.
So, Stephen, job growth looks a little slower because we didn't fall as much in the first place during the recession. Is that, do you think there's something to that?
There could be. I mean, that is true that we did not get hit nearly as hard as some of the other states during the Great Recession because our housing market did not go through the same kind of bubble that so many other states did, particularly Florida and Nevada and California to an extent. But you would think that if we did not get hit by the recession, that would, as strongly as other states, that would put us in a better position to take advantage of the national growth. And we're not seeing that. So partially what's happening is that the state is kind of almost in a kind of a neutral. It's not really moving forward. It's not moving backwards. And it's to an extent that we're kind of like, what's it going to take to kind of get it moving farther ahead?
So what would it take to get it moving farther ahead? Let's start with you on this one, Noah.
So that's a difficult question, and it's actually something that's been addressed sort of nationally. I mean, I think what's going on, and if you want to characterize that, that's what's going on in the state. I mean, that's sort of a debate which has happened nationally and actually around the world. Recovery, economic growth has been relatively slow coming out of this recession, certainly in comparison to past recessions. And there is actually an underlying debate, nationally about, what are the factors for this? Is it an actual slowdown in our underlying productivity growth, or is there their hangover from the recession, or are there some policy things which are perhaps restraining growth? And so those are the things which, I mean, I think are yet to be sorted out in the data. And, depending on which of those is sort of a driving force, those would actually have different remedies.
Well, I want to ask each of you, how much control does a state have? I mean, it sometimes feels like, you're trying to steer a battleship with a wooden oar. If all you have are the state government policy tools at your hand, you're trying to affect an economy that's sailing the ocean of national and international economics. Stephen?
It depends on whether your view is long-term or short-term. I mean, if you're thinking, what can we do to increase productivity over the long-term? I mean, that's a big-picture type question, and that's something that we could spend all afternoon talking about. I think the short-term type thinking is, what can we do to kind of goose the economy to get it forward? I think one of the big questions that we're facing right now, and I think that European countries are facing this question right now, is whether or not a policy of fiscal austerity is really a good short-term strategy. There are arguments that fiscal austerity is that we've got to get our fiscal house in order. We have to do that. But given the current economic situation, is now the time to do that? So I think part of the question that we should be having, part of the debate that we should be having now, is whether or not the short-term policies of fiscal austerity within Wisconsin is really the right thing to be doing at this particular point in time.
And Noah, your thoughts on the state's toolkit, what can be done short or long-term?
So I agree that sort of thinking about the longer-term trends, I mean, there are important sort of regional and sectoral differences which happen to states. I mean, Back in mid-2000s, I remember when I was actually at Princeton, I was advising a thesis of somebody who was from North Dakota and talking about the severe problems they had in North Dakota. Well, you know, 10 years later, there's an energy boom in North Dakota. Unemployment rates are 3%. So there's a lot of things which are outside the control of state government, certainly. But looking at, you know, what are the policy toolkits? I mean, I think, you know, certainly tax policy is, I would argue, an important aspect. A large, you know, thinking about job growth and also thinking about economic growth more broadly, there's been a real slowdown in business investment, and so anything we can do to help spur investment will help along those lines. And I think there have been some measures in the state to try to encourage that.
We're talking to UW-Madison economists Noah Williams and Stephen Deller about how Wisconsin's economy is faring compared to the rest of the country.
And we'd like to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you concerned that Wisconsin is falling behind the rest of the country economically, or do you think it's keeping pace, and why? Do you think the state's economic well-being is a product of government policy, or are there different factors at play? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about how Wisconsin's economic performance compares with the rest of the country, and we're getting two different perspectives right now from UW-Madison economists Noah Williams and Stephen Deller.
And we'd like to hear from you. 800-642-1234 is the number. If you have a question about the state's economy or a thought, call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. To calls in just a moment, Stephen, first I wanted to let you follow up on this concept of business investment, why we're not seeing more of it in Wisconsin, as Noah was talking about.
I think that's a very important question. I think that's both a short-term and a long-term question. The question is, why aren't businesses making these investments? And there's a couple of different hypotheses out there, and I think we really don't know the answer. We won't know the answer for a couple of years to come. The economic historians may be able to answer it 10 years from now. But I've heard both sides of the arguments that businesses are saying that they're hesitant on making investments because they're unsure about the economy. They're not sure about the job growth, they're not sure about income growth, and they're hesitant on that. The other side of the argument that I've heard is that banks, and I use banks generically here, are sitting on a ton of cash. And if you look at the data in terms of cash reserves, the banks are really being extremely conservative in terms of loaning that money out. So is it that the businesses are hesitant on making those investments, or is it that the banks are hesitant on financing those investments? We don't know the answer, but the point is that those investments are not being made.
I want to bring a caller in here now. We've got Ben on the line in Eagle River. Ben, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to bring up, Ben?
I was curious what the impact that service jobs, the increase in that compared to manufacturing or other better-paying jobs with better benefits is having on the state's economy.
Ben, interesting. Thanks for bringing that up. That's been a concern. Are we losing manufacturing jobs, getting more service sector jobs? Thoughts on that, Stephen?
I think that you need to, when you talk about, there's two things. One is when you talk about the service sector, that's a very broad sector. For example, I've been looking at the role of hospitals in the state's economy. And when you think of hospitals, that's a service sector. But you have jobs all the way from very high-paid medical doctors that are specialists all the way down to entry food service providers. So it's really very, very broad in terms of that. So there are some very high-paying jobs and very good jobs in the service sector. There are also some low-paying jobs within the service sector. The other thing is that with manufacturing, is that because of international competition, wages are being driven down. It's increasingly the case that, back 30, 40 years ago, getting a job paying $25 an hour with benefits with a high school degree in manufacturing, those days are pretty much gone. So it seems like a straightforward question, but there's no easy answer.
No, I wanted to, that reminds me, I wanted to ask you about wages and salary. One thing we're trying to measure is how many jobs are out there.
Sure.
Another important measure, and you wrote about this in the piece that kicked this whole discussion off, is, okay, but what are we getting paid at these jobs?
Yeah, and I think, again, We want to look at, well, first, just one note on investment before turning to that. It's very difficult to get investment data at the state level. So I've tried looking into this and didn't find very much. I did find there was one recent study by Ernst & Young, which sort of talks about, you know, incoming investment of different projects. And I did see that Wisconsin was rated in the top 10 in the nation, at least for 1 year on that. It's just one particular data point, but it does suggest that, you know, perhaps we may see some more investment in the state. Looking to answer your question about incomes and wages, or wages and incomes more broadly, again, I think looking at sort of a number of different indicators, I don't think we're seeing, I mean, often you hear the, what seemed to be maybe the subtext, I don't want to read into the caller's question, but they were shifting from a high wage to a low wage economy. And I don't think you see that in the data at all. If anything, I mean, you see that average wages and average incomes in Wisconsin have tracked the national average, and depending on the particular indicator, perhaps surpassed them over the past roughly 4 or 5 years, certainly since 2011. And perhaps importantly, and this gets back to the question of sort of policy impact, if we look at after-tax incomes, those have actually gone up more quickly in the state than the nation as a whole. So that is, if you want to look at one place where policy has had an impact, I mean, certainly if there's been a reduction in taxes, that shows up directly in disposable income.
Well, Stephen, did you have a thought on that?
One question, and again, this is, again, we could spend all afternoon talking about it, is that you may see average income increasing, but the problem is what's happening to the distribution around that average. And this is where the growth in employment opportunities kind of appear to be at the two ends of the distribution, either very low paying jobs or very high paying jobs. That middle of the distribution, that growing middle class, seems to be hollowing out. That's something that has been going on for 30 years, depending on which data source you use. But it's a question that I think we need to spend a little bit more time thinking about. So the average is important, but I think that distribution around the average is growing in more importance.
No, I know this has been an issue on the national political stage, income inequality. Are we able to measure it? What do we know about it at a state-by-state level, maybe at a place like Wisconsin?
The only sort of comparisons that I've seen are between averages and medians, which is just one, you know, very narrow slice of how to get at inequality. And in that sense, you know, it's hard to, you know, there's not a whole lot of data, and it's hard to say, but I haven't seen a growth there. But I don't think I would dispute that there has been a growth in inequality, again, essentially around the world.
In our last couple minutes, I want to ask each of you in turn what you're going to be watching for in the future, what signs and portents and tea leaves you have your eyes on. Let's start with Steve.
I think I'm going to stay on the state budget. And I think what we're seeing right now is a start of a pushback on the fiscal austerity. I think we're starting to see, and we're seeing that in the Joint Finance Committee in the terms of the way that they're trying to modify Walker's budget proposals. I think that we've hit a point in the state where people are starting to say, wait a minute, yes, we like lower taxes, but there are some services that we want to maintain, and we're not willing to cut those particular services. So I think in the short term, I think that the state has to have a debate about whether or not the Walker policies of fiscal austerity are right for Wisconsin.
And Noah, what are you looking forward to finding out? What are you keeping an eye on when you leave the studio today?
So I'm certainly keeping an eye to see whether we do have continued improvement in unemployment. I mean, as I've talked about in my piece, and I think sometimes gets lost in the debate, is, I mean, ultimately, you know, once everybody has a job, job growth doesn't really become as important an indicator. It's more closely tied to population growth. And that sort of brings up another issue, which is that the population growth rate in Wisconsin has been actually relatively low in comparison to the nation. Part of that is, again, demographic, but then there is also some evidence that, again, this is over a number of years, that there has been sort of net out-migration. So to the extent that people are, you know, making their migration decisions for economic reasons, we would like to see that turn around.
That might be a good starting point for our next discussion. Noah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Steve, thanks to you as well.
Thanks.
We've been talking to UW-Madison economists Stephen Deller and Noah Williams about Wisconsin's economic well-being compared with the rest of the country. You can keep this conversation going, by the way, over at the Central Time Facebook page.